Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books and Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Christopher Russell, host of today's episode with Dr. Christina Griffin, a psychoanalyst, forensic psychologist, and writer. Dr. Griffin is a native Californian, migrating from south to north multiple times. She has degrees in social work, religious studies, psychology, and psychoanalysis, and has practiced for 25 years with individuals from all walks of life. She is co-president of the International Forum for Psychoanalytic Education, a home for thinking and open discourse characterized by willingness to engage with both ideas and experience. She is a supervising and training analyst for the Institute for Contemporary Psychoanalysis. She teaches clinical psychology practicum to third-year doctoral candidates at Pacifica Graduate Institute. Dr. Griffin writes creative nonfiction, fiction and memoir, where her interests are the objects of desire, poetic memory, and the tragic romantic aspects of human subjectivity. She joins us today to discuss her new book, The Regulars Table, about Hungarian psychoanalyst Sándor Ferenczi and his literati friendships. Dr. Griffin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Sure. So tell us, what prompted you? What led you to write the book?
I actually had an experience while doing some beginning reading and research on Sándor Ferenczi. And that was many, many years ago, 10 maybe, a little more. But I was reading a collection of essays about Ferenczi. And I came across a eulogy that was written by one of his closest friends, a long personal eulogy, the like that we don't see much of them like that anymore, I don't think. They're beautiful, like little novels and novellas themselves. So the good friend was had a pen name, Ignotius, which means the unknown, but it was Hugo Wieselberg, and he was one of three founding editors for the New Yacht political and literary journal in Budapest, which was founded about the turn of the century, just before. So in his memoriam for Ferenczi, I came across this paragraph and I was really blown away. I was experiencing a couple different kind of emotions, and one of them was envy. So I'm going to read it to you. And you can see, and then we can talk. Many years later, I can see the two of us sat in his consulting room one Sunday afternoon when he didn't have patients. We sat side by side in silence, holding hands with our eyes closed, observing our thoughts, and then each scribbling down on a piece of paper what they had thought, what had come to mind, and comparing the two scraps. We saw that what had come into my mind was associated with the logic of Freudian dream interpretation with what Ferenczi had thought of. And so I believed in the transference of thoughts. And so what was going on in a small way in the Vaso Maggiore and Ezerbe Avenue must have been going on throughout the world on a far grander scale. And today, as the new physics has engendered a new view of the world, the new analysis has engendered a new view of the person. So I read this and I thought, these two friends met for years, just a little after the turn of the century, in Ferenczi's office on Sunday evenings. And they stayed up all night practicing thought transference. And I thought, I want to do it. I want to have a friend just try this experiment. How could we do this today in California? So that's what really got me going on the book originally. And that's at least been about, oh, I think a decade ago when I read it. So that started the percolation of everything.
And so did you find someone to do the experiment with?
Well, I did. You know, my first thought, because I was pretty determined as I thought about it. I thought of two people, but they didn't live in my town, not even in my state. You know, East Coast, West Coast, that kind of feeling. Those two people I thought of would have been people that would have been intrigued and not thought it was really strange or rolled their eyes. And so I kind of ruled them out in my head without asking. And then I thought, I really want someone in my town. And I think that in the context of, not living in a big city anymore, I was dealing with sort of boredom, ennui, the French term, kind of a intellectual of boredom, feeling a bit isolated. But then there was someone I had met, and I thought about it more. So I started having a conversation with this man, and he said yes. And so we began our own version of emulating Chandra Ferenczi and Ignatius once a week. What we did early on, as I recall, we would switch homes, and in Southern California, it's outdoors, beautiful gardens. So one week we would meet, and for an hour, but we'd meet in silence. And we'd say hi. We could have a glass of wine, but we'd sit and we'd have blank pages of paper, and we would just tried without inhibition, like a free associative process, write down our thoughts and maybe try to guess a little bit or catch the mood non-verbally of the other person. So we would write what was on our minds. Then what we would do is we would hand each other the set of papers and not discuss them. And we'd say goodbye and we'd take the others home and then we'd read them. So over the years, and now I'm still doing this with this person, which I wrote about in the book. That's a portion of the book, this experiment. We call it silent writing. And we rarely discussed anything. I mean, I think in the last couple of years, a few themes have come up because we meet at other times for social or professional events. And we have kept this ritual up. At least when we're in town weekly, and we are going into our 7th or 8th year, which is pretty remarkable. And we have a stack of papers on the other person, and it's quite high. we haven't analyzed it either, but, you know, inspired by this eulogy, it's very remarkable that we're still doing it, and a lot has come from it.
Well, it's interesting. You said when you read the eulogy that there was a sense of envy. Has doing the silent writing satisfied that, gratified it?
Well, it has to a degree locally. It's satisfied very much in terms of having, I think, the kind of friendship that really inspired the regulars table. These deep, enduring friendships that's not just Chandor and Ignatius, but between, you know, Chandor encouraged this in the coffee house society, the cafe society in Budapest, just around the turn of the century and through the 1920s, I would say. It has satisfied me. It's taken its own little development and own identity. It's not exactly at this point practicing thought transference, but it's certainly satisfied an enduring deep friendship. And you know, the research that I began really included reading the novels, many novels and poetry of the Hungarian friends of Ferenczi. Ferenczi's father owned a bookstore, and Ferenczi was very much a reader himself, not just of the, you know, psychology, psychoanalysis, but of everything, political, anthropological, anything cultural, literary, poetic, the arts. So through Ferenczi and what I started researching, names came up. I didn't know much about Hungary and the novelists and the writers of the time. And I'm not sure the world does. Hungarians know about this, but that center was the most prolific, productive center in Europe, beyond Vienna, beyond Paris, in terms of the timing and how much was being produced, thought, shared, and written at that time. It was a really amazing finding to me, knowing just a little bit about that the history of psychoanalysis and literature was very much intertwined. But it was also a really rich discovery that so much had gone on, and, you know, who knew? I didn't
know either, and I was really thrilled. So who, you introduced them in the book, who are the regulars? Who's around the table that makes it into the book?
Well, there's the novelist Sándor Márai. And he, you know, people that I've talked to said, you know, had it been known, he was, you know, up at the level of a Nobel Prize in literature. And I've read some of his books that were they were translated in English not till much later in the 1960s, 70s, and beyond. So that I read them, and I was really blown away. I mean, I'm just beautiful, beautiful writing. So Sándor Márai, Dezső Kastélyány, which is a very popular novelist and poet and character. Looking at his photos, reading his books, he's a bit of a dandy and Oscar Wilde type. When you look at his photographs and just the way he posed and the remarks he would make and kind of oppositional, outrageous. Fascinating, entertaining. He was a real butterfly, social butterfly. So those two novelists, Ignatius was another one. And there was another writer, Caranti Figueres, and he was an interesting person. I think that in the popular culture, one of his articles, it was lesser known and not as important at the time, but it was called Chain Links. We've all heard this expression. I think there's even a play called 6 Degrees of Separation. That was he that coined that phrase. He was one of the regulars sitting around the table with Ferenczi. André with an E, Addy, a poet, and Attila Joseph, another poet. And those were the regulars, you know, the tight-knit group. Now, In historical correctness, most of those people, yes, they were at his table possibly at the same time. I chose my favorites, just the writing that interested me that I related to, because there were so many others that Ferenczi knew. You know, he knew, and he would go, apparently, I've learned this through, you know, my fortunate, you know, meetings with and new friendships with Hungarian psychoanalysts who are also quite historians. One of them is Judith Mesheros, who's been the president of the International Ferenczi Network, and she let me in the Ferenczi house and looked in some of the archives, and, you know, we've had a couple meetings, but she's been very generous and shared with me some stories that she really knew about, of where Ferenczi would sit with one person by himself and in a cafe and get home at 3 a.m, just talking and so stimulating, you know, all the new findings in physics and literature, poetry, politics of the time. So I got the idea based on history, but what I did with this book, I would call it like a semi-speculation. What I finally arrived at was, you know, imagining minds. And I think that's what we do in psychoanalysis. There's a famous quote, short quote of Keats. I think I'll read it. I had it out for this interview because it relates to how I've, you know, formed the book and imagined the minds of this regulars group. So Keats said, "One of the most mysterious of semi-speculations is, one would suppose, that of one mind's imagining into another." And that's kind of what I did.
Well, yeah, there's a wonderful part where, and I can't remember, you imagine, Ferenczi, and you take as the, I guess you found it written somewhere or something, and he talks to his friends who did not sleep well last night, and then you would imagine an entire conversation.
Yeah, I think that may be one of the last chapters. Yeah, I'll read a little bit of it. How's that?
Sure.
Just a little bit.
That's
okay.
Great, yeah.
That's the last chapter. Yeah, and I decided to end with this chapter because it was a wonderful place to end where they kind of regathered. And so I picked, it's called One Morning in May 1910 at the Café Royal in Budapest. And by the way, I've gone to these cafes. I've had through friends take me on tours of the cafes that used to exist and now they're laundromats. But some really, really, you know, do exist still. Yeah, the Café Royal still exists. The New York still exists. And the Café Central still exists, for those of you that will ever want to go to Budapest. So anyway, this morning, and, you know, in my book I'm in Ferenczi's head. It's me imagining Ferenczi's thoughts. They're based on history, but it's a semi-speculation. And then I make up the dialogue, pretty much. Ferenczi looked out of his apartment window at the Hotel Royal across the street. He began his walk to join his friends at their table, and he walked slowly, musing. "I didn't sleep much last night, and it doesn't seem to matter or affect my sense of well-being today. I feel so refreshed and such extraordinary satisfaction. I am reassured that future generations can have the prospect of free and open discourse. I myself seem to have changed somewhat from recent talks in Vienna with Freud, which has helped me rediscover, something that had eluded me, the individual strivings of the libido. Now here in Budapest, I am, of course, thinking about the day's patients, one who is reading the newspapers to check for the impending danger of Halley's Comet, and the one who I had to expel a while ago, her state of transference having used the catastrophe threatened by the oncoming comet. Having made that association, I wanted to write to Freud. I put to him, and will again put to friends at the cafe, particularly our circle of sociologists, yesterday's experience of teaching. I was invited to give a lecture on the new Freudian theories, exploring the unconscious. I cannot fall asleep easily because of this great revolution in psychology. And in fact, I'm so aware that there is a revolution in everything connected with psychology. Well, I cannot sleep. It's astonishing to me that all of this is happening in my lifetime. These young sociologists were actually the most intelligent and understanding audience that I have ever had the opportunity to address. There were 7 or 8 young doctoral candidates. Truly, youth is our only hope, I wrote to Freud. They have enthusiasm. I'm bringing into the course 3 non-physicians, an educator, Shandor Varas, and a gifted writer, Ignatius, and the chief director of the National Theater, Shandor Hevesy. Here they are. It inspires me seeing these friends around the table. I see them laughing at something Castellani has said. They are all talking, interrupting. Marais looks intent, but somber. I love all of this. You know, I'm reading it now, and I remember this is me imagining it in his mind. However, the Halley's Comet, those kinds of facts, like if you're a fact checker, but they all came out of the 3 volumes of the Freud-Ferenczi correspondence and the endnotes in those books. So those 3 volumes are just, I mean, they're huge. They were translated into English at the end of the 90s, the 1990s. That's when the renaissance of Ferenczi knowledge and interest really occurred. But I read, especially volume 1, all of the letters between Freud and Ferenczi So when I write about this table and the people, those names, the people that were at the table in this passage I just read, they were actually there. And Ferenczi actually just gave a lecture to the young sociologist, and there is a letter saying how inspired he was that he wrote to Freud. You know, people wrote, well, some people, I guess, I don't know if everyone did, but they wrote with such intimacy and such detail and such feeling. I think there goes my feelings, you know, of envy that, you know, when people are passionate about something and there's a lot of aliveness and movement. And that's what I got from these old letters. And the more I delved into this, and that's what inspired my own writing and imagination about this.
Well, it's as you were reading it, and I remember reading it, the intimacy really, really comes through. I think somewhere you're either quoting or summing up Ferenczi, who's had this idea that Freud pursued secrets, I seek intimacy, and it's pretty much shot through. You have some intimate experiences with people throughout the book. One of them, which is really lovely to read. Can you talk a little bit about the Finger of God chapter and uncanny, the interruption, and everything that happens on that flight?
Okay, well, that was something. You know, one can make a plan to go somewhere and have some downtime, but also try to, you know, accomplish certain things and have certain meetings. So I went for an adventure. I had like one appointment. Two good friends and myself, we were going to it's a Jungian, the Art and Psyche conference, which was held in Syracuse, Sicily. And this was in 2017. So we went to give a presentation, and we all talked a little bit about Ferenczi. It was about the Freud-Ferenczi split, which occurred historically in Palermo. So we had just unbelievably wonderful time. After that conference, I had planned to go to Budapest for a week, my first visit. So I remember saying goodbye to a good friend in the airport in Rome and going and jumping on a Wizz Airlines to Budapest, not knowing anything other than a couple people had written me saying there was, you know, all the immigration from Syria, the borders of Hungary were starting to be closed. They were putting up barbed wire fence, shoving, you know, hordes of people out of the train station. So they said, you better check it out, make sure it's safe to go. But I called some of my people that I was going to meet there. They said, oh, it should be fine. So I went on the plane ride, chapter 8, Finger of God. This is when I call it the interruption. All my plans change. I had my seat assignment. I walked to the seat. I thought I had the window seat. And there was this couple, I could just tell it was really intense stress between them. And I was so tired. We got them so early on Sicily. I just, for some reason, I said, okay, I'll take the middle seat. And I did. But the man who I'd hardly noticed because I was exhausted, started speaking to me. He was Hungarian, but really good English. And we got into this conversation, which I go blow by blow in this chapter. So something happened between us. You know, we hear about these things sometimes traveling. Well, nothing like this has ever happened to me, and I've traveled quite a bit in my life and you know, met interesting people. But I think, well, I know something more happened. By the end of the trip, I mean, he had asked me, and I had to think about it. He said he wanted to show me, if I was comfortable, the real Hungary. And he had told me a little bit about his family, and so we jumped into an Uber, something like an Uber, which they're illegal in Hungary, but we somehow got to my hotel and made plans. From that, we had a couple meetings that week, but the first one really changed everything. I had a couple good nights sleep, and I met this man, Tibor. There are many Tibors, by the way, in Budapest, so that doesn't give anybody away. There's like thousands of Tibor something. It's a very popular name. He was a doctoral student, actually had been in the United States studying for a while at Stanford and came back. was working at one of the universities there, and he took me on a tour, but something happened, I think, really between us, and that's what I wrote about. There was just starting on the plane, there was this just, I'm going to call it the uncanny, a very intuitive connection that even, you know, I canceled a few things. We just went and had, you know, really unusual, unforgettable time, which inspired this chapter. This chapter was a complete accident in the book. This was not going to even be part of the book, but once I went to Budapest and learned through this man's eyes, and I remember asking him on the plane, he finally wanted to know what I was, and he knew about psychoanalysts, what they were, and I said, well, have you ever heard of Sándor Ferenczi? And he just sort of dismissed it. He goes, of course, you know, like, okay, big deal. But I didn't think it was like just a little thing. So, you know, in many of our conversations and places we went, I learned a little more. Come to find months later, there's a very important key figure, a man named Dr. André Heinel, who in the history of Ferenczi. He is the man that shepherded all of Ferenczi's letter and correspondent. I think there are over 1,200 documents. He was entrusted to do this, and they went to first Michael Balint, then to his first wife, and then to his next wife, Enid Balint, and she entrusted them to André Heinel. So I mention his name, and then I'll connect it. It turns out André and his wife were invited out to Los Angeles to give a talk, to have a salon on Ferenczi. And before I went in to LA, live north of Los Angeles, I emailed Tibor. And I said, by any chance, it had never occurred to me, I goes, do you know, have you ever heard of this man, this person? And it was just like a bolt of lightning. It turns out that André Heinel's father had adopted and raised Tibor, the man I met's father. They were Tibor's family's closest friends. And the facts are that Tibor's grandfather's parents were killed in the Holocaust. And when this grandfather was a little child, André Heinel's father adopted. And so this family's been entwined in, you know, the history of psychoanalysis in their own personal way forever. And we were just both blown away. And the years go by, and, you know, I became very good friends with André Heinel and Veronique. Every time they would come out here, we presented together. Hungary's a small country, and so the woman I mentioned earlier, Judith Mesheros, president of the Ferenczi, and she has the keys to the Ferenczi house in Budapest. She and André, you know, André wrote his memoir. I helped be an English language reader for it. It's all entwined. But really, I mean, things happen randomly. And I think I said something in the book, and I believe that a psychoanalyst says there's no such thing as a coincidence. Well, maybe not. You know, I sat down next to this man. I wouldn't have gotten to know him if I hadn't just sort of sat between this feuding couple. Well, they weren't a couple. They were colleagues and had been to a conference presenting. But one thing happened after the other. And, we're all friends today, you know. So it was a gift.
I mean, it's remarkable.
It is just unbelievable to me how the history came around. And André Heinel, you know, to be entrusted, he calls it the emigration of the archives, carrying these papers. This was in the 80s, 1983, when he was entrusted. And then he became the lead editor of the publication of the three volumes of the Freud-Ferenczi correspondence. That's one of his major things that he's done so many things in his life. And he recently died in November. So in that Finger of God chapter, allowing for the interruption, the book just sort of came together and sprang from that chapter. This is what interrupted my plans. Had I not gone with this man, hadn't I not had the conversation, allowed the interruption, took a risk, went with him, and all this would have I would have never known, wouldn't have happened. It added so much richness to my life and inspiration. It made it very real, a living history, you know, kind of the legacy of this excitement and the passionate friendships.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I felt like I got
and 6 degrees of separation. Fewer than six.
Oh, exactly. And that's just always been amazing to me. You know, we all say that phrase, but it happened at that table. I don't think no one knows that.
I did not know that until I read the book, and now it's one of my new favorite facts. Well, I'm thinking from the psychoanalytic, this idea of allowing the interruption, which I think is what can happen in a session when the unconscious interrupts, when free associate, allowing for interruption and the richness and the intimacy that it can bring is really superb. And you wrote, Heinle is somehow associated with this book or helping you to put it together in a little bit. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, he got here. I'm trying to think before I went to Budapest, I knew about him. I'd read some things of his. That spring in Toronto, there was a international Ferenczi conference. This is how it was. And I was presenting something. And I was presenting some of the beginning writing about the regulars table, okay? Before I even really thought it was a book. It was a paper, okay? It started with a paper. I was on a panel with someone, but at the last minute, I got randomly put with Andre Heinle on the panel and this Judith Mesheros, the woman I mentioned. So we presented together, and it all started then when we presented, and right afterwards, the conversation. But I had written to him. It just occurred to me again, you know, I just talk about the intuition. I thought, I'm just going to write to him and see if he knows anything about Chandor Marais, the novelist, or any of these novelists. Did his family know? Because he's, you know, born in Hungary and Budapest. Well, he wrote me back, you know, 9 hours time difference. By the way, he and his wife had lived in Geneva, Switzerland. He never moved back to Budapest, but he was in Geneva. He wrote me back immediately, and he was so excited. He goes, I know Chandor Far. He goes, well, it's not Chandor, but Marais, Chandor Marais. He goes, my parents knew his parents. We vacationed together. He goes, we must have a meeting together, and I'll tell you all about it. So he arranged this wonderful breakfast. Another intimate breakfast in Toronto, and several of us went, but I mean, he had a little place next to him, and he's a gentleman. He's I hear people say about him, the last of the intellectual European, giants, because he's so broad, like Ferenczi, interdisciplinary, his knowledge. I mean, he was a medical doctor and a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst, but his interest extended many, many ways. So we sat down, and he could have presided, you know, grandly presided, but he's kind. And it was just a very warm conversation, but he told a story about he was a teenager, and they were somewhere on an Italian terrace somewhere, could have been Sicily, somewhere on the ocean, with Chandra Marais, the novelist, and his family and his parents. And Marais kind of cornered him and said, what are you going to do with your life? And he really meant it. I mean, he wasn't superficially asking that kind of a question. And Andre was just like, fixated on this and has never forgotten this conversation and how penetrating his look and his words were and the genuineness of his interest. We had this breakfast, this wonderful meal, and then Andre just started taking an interest. He totally knew what a regulars table was, which, by the way, I guess I should say, I got the title from the German word Stammtisch, which is, loosely translated, means a table that's reserved in a cafe for regular customers. And in the Budapest coffee culture, tables were reserved particularly for writers. They would keep their pens there, their coats, their medications, whatever needed. And they would gather in certain cafes, and they would never have to look for a table. That was their table. So that's the regulars table. And Andre Heinel knew all this kind of history intimately. He just kind of got it. And he also got the idea of imagination, based on history. It's interesting in writing this book, like, what is it? What's the genre? some people are very strict about that. And is it historical fiction? Well, maybe leaning towards that, but maybe not quite, because there's a leap. There's that semi-speculation of imagination. This was something I just so appreciated about Andre, his grasp of this just quickly. Immediately. And, we were able to meet, he and his wife, several other times when he came out to Los Angeles. And I think he wrote one of the endorsements for the book. Very supportive about the whole process. Generous, very generous.
Yeah. And I was thinking, one of the themes in the book, and interestingly enough, in you, is this idea of migration. This book is a migration of ideas, of disciplines, of time. It just moves. I mean, the sort of psychoanalytic idea of there's no time in the unconscious, it's a very present book taking place across time.
Yeah. Well, the papers, the clinical diary and the correspondence between Freud and Ferenczi, technically, had an external migration, but I think that there's many, many books, novels, and films about this. Between the wars, pre World War I and after, when I was doing some of the historic research of the times, that this was in, there was a book. He's very well known historian. It's called Tibor Frank. His Double Exile. He describes, and he has down in detail with his records, the migrations of the Jewish Hungarian professionals from Hungary through Germany to the U.S., like from 1919 to 1945. It's a social history of refugees escaping Hungary after the Bolshevik-type revolution of 1919, and then their counter-revolution and the rise of anti-Semitism. So many of Ferenczi's friends kind of had a double exile. They went to various places in Europe or they came back, and some of them never came back. And some of them went on to the United States. So I think the Hungarian middle class was really torn by World War I, and there were lots of horrible rules and laws curtailing the number of Jewish citizens admitted to higher education. So some stayed and some left. But this is picked up. Ferenczi talks about it in letters, and letters to friends, letters to Freud, a little bit in his diary. This is like the background of all the years they wrote and developed their theories and techniques, and the whole growth and of the new field of psychoanalysis. So that's kind of the background. But I was really, there's that, and I'm not the exact historian. I mean, I'm interested in psychoanalytic history. I have a passion about it, but I'm not the actual fact historian, other than if I'm following a thread that interests me, and it tends to be more literature. So when I started reading Castellani and Chandramare and some of the poets, Andre Addy, there was a theme in this book too, the migration and the fear of vanishing. You know, there's lots of, this is the state of our contemporary world as well. So much was going on at that time. And the fear of vanishing, I think, is, there's a couple interesting little quotes I tried to get out. This is actually, they're really brief. I'm going to read if I can. Dejo Castellani in his book Skylark. Here's one. People disappeared as if I were dreaming. Houses flew off and away on featherweight wings. I stared at the ground. I saw footsteps they pressed. That's how I lived in bombed out Budapest. So I kind of was pulled into that idea of migration and that context of history by the literati, I think, like Ferenczi was. I think there's another one in Mare that, when people go away, they vanish. They turn to nothing. They stop being. They exist only in memories, haunting the imagination. And I wrote about in this book, you know, vanishing haunted me. I think that's something that I think about. I've thought about in my life. When I mentioned, I think in your introduction, migrating back and forth in California, I'm a native California, San Francisco to LA, and multiple moves. It's not the same thing that I was reading. It's not caused by war, but it was that's my own personal history. I think there was a resonance of what it means to keep changing cities, keep changing towns, you know, for whatever reason. Theirs was a serious political reason. But there was some in some ways I related, and that's also kind of what motivated me. I think just, you know, we all get interested. There's something like, as a psychoanalyst, there's something maybe intuitively that we're following in a person when they're talking to us. We don't know what it is actually. We don't allow the space for that to come out. We may never know, but I also think it's something, you know, this is very Ferenczi, and it's something that's in yourself too. You know, it's very much about the, you know, the space in between and the mutuality of the two people in the room. So fear of vanishing is something very much in the literature and poetry of this time in history that spoke to me, but also just it was moving. You know, the language, the way they wrote, it drew me in.
Well, there's definitely some moving passages in the book. And of course, now I'm going to have to get all these Hungarian novelists and read them. I'm completely intrigued. But I'm thinking of vanishing today in two concepts. The analytic, Andre Green and his idea of cathexis, which is the slide into vanishing.
Yeah. Well, we have Amazon, we can order, but, you know, usually I think sometimes we have to do a little research for some of them. They're not, I don't speak Hungarian, of course. Some of them, more of them are in English now.
I was thinking about vanishing also with the fact that this world of gathering around tables has vanished, at least for now, during COVID-19.
Yes. I've had the same thoughts, but I think one of the things we all miss the most is gathering in restaurants or cafes or having a cup of coffee, that casual kind of connection. I know people we're missing travel also, but when we travel, you know, a natural thing we do is we sit in cafes and watch people, or we connect with who we're traveling with, or we connect with new people. And I think there's a interesting parallel. And our field, you know, in psychoanalysis and in psychology, we're trying to offer other kinds of things on the internet, you know, other gatherings like a Zoom gathering when you have a meeting or a block of people or just a discussion about how people are surviving in the virus. So I think we're really missing gathering at a table for a drink, a cup of coffee or some food.
I completely agree. There's a the brewmaster of Brooklyn Brewery here in New York, a guy named Garrett Oliver, he talks about the centrality of the table in the lives of happy people.
Oh, love that.
It's really, he's a great guy. And in the book, you write that part of what you're exploring is, you say, the mysterious process of living among others. We need to talk and share it. And not being able to do it in person is obviously very difficult right now.
It's difficult. And I think the other thing, thinking about migration and change, and, you know, we're a world that there's so many movements because of politics or poverty or opportunity. I mean, we're on hold right now, but there was something for me about wanting, remember we talked about sort of my envy. I wanted deeper enduring friendships. I did not, you know, we go back and forth. We something can be casual and superficial, but I just wanted some intimacy over time, like building some kind of a permanency with a group of friends. And, you know, I actually tried to do that where I live. And I know people do that. They have their own little salons. And I have a group that's been going on. There's four friends. We're all in the same field. And we're all very different from each other, but we meet. And we have a, and sometimes we talk about a book. We have a glass of wine. We have really nice food indoors when it's a little cold, or outdoors in a garden. But it's a bond that you make a commitment to. Now, it's not like a marriage, but it's, you know, it's a group that we want a particular type of conversation that's, you know, non-competitive, that is free, like a forum, a space. And I think that's, you know, I really got the inspiration from Ferenczi. You know, there's an uninhibited kind of conversation. Now, that reminds me, there's a couple of things about the friendships that I got directly out of volume one of the Freud-Ferenczi correspondence that really, I think, the heart of my book is about deep, enduring friendships and what they can be like and why they're important to maintain and, you know, continue on, carry someone. And if I have a little bit of time, I can read them. They're very short. They're portions of sentences. Ferenczi wrote a letter to Freud on October 3rd, 1910. And some of these, for those people that are really into psychoanalytic history, they'll recognize these portions. But for me, it was finding someone, and then, quote, worthwhile to be interested in me. So I'm going to read just a little list. Ferenczi's longing for the personal, uninhibited companionship. Two people who tell each other the truth unrelentingly. I felt the man behind every sentence of your works and made him my confidant. And it's not the end of intimacy, but rather the beginning of a real understanding. Also about friendship, Ferenczi wrote a tribute to Ignatius. By the way, in the journal, the New Yacht, it's N-Y-G, I'm not going to spell it right, the New Yacht. It's in my book. It's a beautiful thing on friendship. It's just a page, but I got these pieces out of it because it speaks to the friendship that was, you know, caught my imagination. So it's the tribute to Ignatius. Understanding in the blink of an eye, the depths to comprehend. The forum, whose opinion I could accept as decisive with almost blind certainty. Laying on the lawn, together, immersed in weaving new thoughts. A person who still followed me on my path without hesitation. You and Robert Baronet, an artist, a painter, were like a genuine institution for me, helping to bear the exclusion by others. And we saw the world differently than we had the day before. These are just little excerpts from this tribute that Ferenczi wrote to his. I felt like Ignatius was like, he had so many good friends, but maybe his best friend. I don't know. He never said anything about a best friend. He'd hoped Freud would be, but they kind of conflicted over the years. But Ignatius was tried and true. Ignatius seemed to be able to bear and take a lot of different things, and he was a very broad-minded, grounded kind of individual. So he, talking to him, being with him, allowed anything. that kind of person.
Yeah, and he seems to satisfy the phrase we used a moment ago, which I just adore, which is intimacy over time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think most of us want that and need that. Sometimes it's hard to find that, and it's hard to maintain it. Things change. We change. The world changes. I think back to what we're in now, the contemporary with the COVID-19, people are really missing people and trying to keep connections going.
Yeah. That's yes. We are indeed. You had another connection to Ferenczi, or the family connection. You talk a little bit, if you can now, about the influence of Calvinism, Judaism, and communion, and how that all came together.
Oh, well, yeah, that was another strange thing. You know, I didn't know that at first, and looking back. So Calvinism, John Calvin's a known figure, an intellectual, studied in Paris, but he's got this clear-cut predestination theory and so on. I know about Calvinism because my father's a Presbyterian minister. At one point, he was the head of the United Presbyterian Church in the what they call the God Box, an inner church center just across from Columbia in New York. So there's Grant's tomb, and then some of the Protestant churches have their headquarters there. So anyway, I've certainly had that in my background. So it turns out that in Hungary, I don't know exactly how this happened, but I think it's the city of Debrecen, but also Budapest. It's considered like the Calvinist Rome, they called it. There's a tremendous, since the turn of the century, late 1800s, establishing schools, kind of Calvinistic Protestant, you know, secondary, elementary and secondary, you know, schools, prep schools, and churches. And it was interesting to me that I always thought Andre Heinel was Jewish because he hung with the Jewish intellectuals. Well, no, he was Calvinist. He was Ritz Calvinist. And Ferenczi himself, he was Jewish, but Ferenczi went to Calvinist schools, which I thought was really interesting. A little known fact. I thought, well, I didn't go to a Calvinist school. I went to public schools. But what might that have been like in Hungary? And, you know, I kind of asked him about that. And that's some of the Jewish students went to those schools as well. So they were just really good schools and very strict and very academic. So he had some of that exposure. But Andre, you know, just personally talking with him, hung with the Jewish intellectuals from his, you know, family and through his father. That's just the heritage that he had. And I think growing up for myself, my father was not friends with any of the Protestant other ministers. Who we had in our home was the rabbi and the Jesuit priests. And it was very interdisciplinary, raised in an ecumenical way. And I think this would be the best of Protestantism. I don't know that that's happening much anymore, but that was my heritage as well. Just without even thinking about it, being raised, and I think Andre and I had talked about this, to have a really ecumenical, to be really knowledgeable about world religions. With, you know, you just, when you're raised and taught that way as a child and as a teenager, you just think, well, that's okay, that's normal, but it isn't these days. So that's a little bit about that.
Well, to me, I brought it up, I remembered it in the book, and it just, to me, the ecumenical, and again, I think you write somewhere in the book that Ferenczi was interested in all that was human. And that that really comes through in the book, in the regulars, what they said, what you go into the mind and have them say. It's really, really beautiful. What are you working on now?
So interesting. I was awarded, to my surprise, it was wonderful, a writer's residency this year for the whole month of February in Spain. It's called the Faber residency. Faber means artisan in Catalan. And so, but what my proposal was a novel, fiction, although I feel like it's a little fiction and some fact, But it's about, now, Fairbairn, the Scottish analyst, has a term called the tantalizing object. And that's the object of desire that you're so drawn to, but it's just out of reach, always frustrating, maintaining its power in a sense. So I'm writing about a woman who kind of is a nomad in her mind, but also travels, a woman later in her life who falls in love. She's a, I will say cisgendered, but straight woman, falls in love with a gay man. And the adventure begins, and it kind of spins her into an odyssey where she has to have a lot of conversations and ends up with, you know, struggling with this, the concept of the tantalizing object, and that she needs to find an antidote or something. So that's, that was my proposal, and that's what I am working on gradually. And that's what I did when I was in a beautiful part of northern Spain for February. And I was with a group of 8 people from all over the world. I was the American, and Ireland, South America, Greece, Finland. I made some really good friends, and I'll tell you, it's one of the best experiences, as well as doing this book and, you know, my trip to Budapest, but enriching, motivating experiences and conversations. Again, there is no structure other than you have your own beautiful room and you're there to write, and you don't have to be, it was not a factory. They just want to give the, you know, the artisan time to write and create. So we had our breakfast together, 2-hour breakfast, you know, conversations, then we could write, take a walk, and then we had our dinners, and very much like a regular table. This group, we were fortunate, really, there's a lot of great connection, and I think I made 2 really good friends that I will, you know, be in touch with for a long time. So that's what I'm working on. I don't really have an exact title, but it's something like In Pursuit of the Tantalizing Object. That could change, as I know, as this book changed.
Well, obviously, we look forward to that, and you'll come back and join us to talk about tantalizing objects when it's published.
Sounds fun. Sounds good.
Great. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us for the book. I think we need Ferenczi always, but certainly right now. And again, thanks for coming to the program.
Oh, thanks so much for hosting, Christopher. Enjoyed.